Welcome to Going Long with FCLT Global, the podcast that dives into the world of long-term investing and strategic decision-making, hosted by Sarah Williamson. Going Long features thought-provoking conversations with some of the brightest minds in finance, economics, and business today. Each episode will bring you exclusive interviews with renowned executives, investors, and experts who are driving change in the world of finance, getting their unique perspectives and uncovering strategies that have shaped their success. Whether you're an investor, a business leader, or simply curious about the forces shaping our global economy, join us as we explore the power of long-term thinking. This is Going Long with FCLT Global.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Going Long. Today's guest is Rochelle Sampson. Rochelle is an associate professor of logistics, business, and public policy at the University of Maryland Smith School of Business. Her recent work exposes rising short-termism in U.S. firms and capital markets, outlining implications for firm productivity and growth, the changing nature of R&D within firms, and environmental impact. She's also the recipient of the inaugural Panmure House Prize. Panmure House is where Adam Smith lived and died in Edinburgh, Scotland, and the prize recognizes early academics who are researching the long-term funding of innovation. So, Rochelle, thank you very much for being here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation, Sarah.
So we saw each other in Edinburgh at Panmure House just a few weeks ago for the presentation of the prize. But maybe you could just get us started with a quick overview of the research you conducted, how you went about this, and just take us through a little bit of what you learned doing this research.
Absolutely. We started with a couple of observations, which was that despite increasing spending on research and development by companies, that we were seeing declining or flat research and development productivity among firms. And this was a curious finding, right? Because if firms are spending more, they should be getting more out of it. And at the same time, a colleague of mine and I had been engaged in some research that showed rising short-termism among firms. And in the sense that their future cash flows were being more heavily discounted. And we had the question, well, is it possible that rising short-termism is responsible for the changing nature of R&D in firms such that they're less focused on breakthrough innovations, and that's responsible in part for what we see in this declining R&D productivity. So we set about to investigate this among all firms that are listed on U.S. exchanges, so publicly listed companies, both American and foreign. And what we found was that, in fact, rising short-termism is very strongly positively correlated with this reduction in breakthrough innovation. So the more short-term a firm is, the less likely they are to produce these breakthrough innovations. And what we mean by breakthrough are the ones that have significant influence on later innovations that a lot of next generation inventions are building upon. And these breakthrough inventions usually require more than just one invention. They require sort of development of many sub-technologies in order to support that main invention. So we found that, and then we went to see if it was causal and used some techniques for that to identify whether or not we could perhaps point the finger at rising short-termism as being one possible explanation for this. And we found indeed that was the case, that the more short-term oriented firms were, the less likely they were both to engage in patents, produce patents, as well as more breakthrough inventions.
So I think the point on breakthrough inventions is what really sets this apart. So you've described this as inventions that do two things. One is they have underlying parts. It's not just a eureka moment and you're done. And it's also something that other things then refer to, which of course takes some time to see what other things refer to. Can you give some examples of some of those things and then what those breakthrough inventions led to?
Sure. So one example that we talk about in the paper is sort of the development of the laser printer. and by Xerox. And this was very much a breakthrough invention. The underlying technologies or sub-technologies just simply did not exist for the laser printer at the time. They were based on copying at that time was based on very different technologies. And so this was developed by the Xerox PARC lab in California. And basically, Gary Starkweather, who was one of the main inventors, had to solve a number of problems that were these sub-technologies underlying the development of the laser printer. Now, of course, once the laser printer was developed, that led to enormous technology changes, both in printing as well as optics, et cetera, because of all of these sub-technology problems they solved, but also the laser printer itself. And that itself morphed and changed dramatically over 30 years. It basically was something that used to take up an entire room, these laser printers, and now, of course, can fit on your desk. So that's one example, but it can even be something much more simple as if you remember the overhead projectors that we might have had in our classrooms growing up. Now we have these, you know, PowerPoint projectors. But these overhead projectors had a lens that was specially developed for them to enable this technology to happen. And many new technologies were built on that. Everything from, you know, sort of traffic lights to other machinery, et cetera. And other forms of optical developments. So those are sort of two kind of simple examples that we all see in our everyday life that would be examples or illustrations of these breakthrough inventions. But of course, we know of others too around biotechnology, new drugs. We see the mRNA technology is so important for vaccines now. So this would be considered a breakthrough invention, and there are many others.
So thinking about these breakthrough inventions is, I mean, that's what innovation is really for, not changing the color of the car or whatever. And so so can you describe a little bit more about what kind of firms are most innovative, and how do you think about measuring what's a short-term firm and what's not? So because it's pretty clear that the more short-term oriented firms are less innovative, but how do you measure that? And what do the innovators look like?
Sure. So in terms of capturing short-termism, the ideal way would be to be able to look inside the firm and capture their sort of hurdle rate, if you will. So what is the rate that they're applying to decide on whether to make certain types of investments? And that hurdle rate reflects a lot of things, but we do know that the higher that rate, the less likely a firm will be to undertake investments that may have a very large payoff, but are more in the future. So what we did is an attempt to capture that using things that we can actually observe across a large number of firms, right? So all firms that are listed on U.S. exchanges. And what we did is we estimated at the firm level what we call an implied discount rate. And what this is essentially a discount on the future cash flows of the firm in the forms of, say, earnings or dividends that would be coming to, say, an investor investing that particular stock over and above the typical discount rates that we would use for a firm. So a company's specific risk premium, which takes into account the firm's profile in terms of their industry sector, how much risk is involved, how much volatility in the market, as well as a risk-free rate of return, which captures sort of the market-wide expected return, you know, without risk, right? So, and numerous other factors go into that. So anything over and above those factors, we would expect to be random if there isn't this element of rising short-termism. So we estimated this at the firm level from 1980 to basically 2020. And essentially got that measure for the firm and found that on average, this is rising over time across the market. But also we looked at individual firms and found for the vast majority of firms in our sample, it's rising for them. So this is not just turnover in the market, say firms becoming private or new firms becoming public. It's existing firms that are staying on the market and what's happening to them, right? So that's how we're capturing short-termism. And then in terms of what these more innovative firms look like, the ones that are generating more of these breakthrough inventions tend to be engaged in more sort of complex technology domains, if you will. And so let me describe what that means. So one is that much of their research, there's links to scientific references. So their inventors are publishing in scientific journals, which indicates that there's some real basic science advancement that are coming about as a result of this research. We also see that there's some, they're more likely to have some government funding for their research. So the government will, and this is the US government specifically, will only invest in projects that are likely to have sort of a spillover effect or a progenerative effect in terms of innovation. So they're more likely to receive that. They're also just more likely to be in domains where we see a lot more technology ferment. Now, those are more characteristics of the firms in some ways. But what we also see is that they have an investor base that are holding shares for a longer period of time in these large blocks. And this is something that we've tried to use to determine causality that I alluded to before, that it is rising short-termism that is responsible in part for this declining breakthrough innovation. So investor block holders, that is those that are holding 5% or more of a firm's shares, if they are more dedicated, they don't turn over those shares as often, they hold them for a longer period of time, that's also very strongly indicative of a firm that is engaged in these breakthrough inventions, right, or long-term complex research projects.
And you're looking at what I find so interesting about this work is that you looked at the indicators of short-termism on a company-by-company level, so at a firm level, and you can't see it on our podcast, but you can see the charts if you look up the work, which showed both a lot of short-termism, in other words, a lot of the dots on the short-term side of the line, as well as rising short-termism over time. So one of the things that I find very interesting is that you can, it's not the market in general, it's actually firm by firm. And that was one of the important things that I think this research shed light on, that you can trace the same firm over time and see what's happening with it. And then tie that to some of its measures of innovation. And I think that's one of the things that, at least to my knowledge, nobody has ever tried to do before, let alone succeeded in doing. Is that fair?
I think that's accurate. We are not the first to use this kind of measure, but we are the first to use it and estimate it at the firm level, and also to correlate it with many other firm characteristics. So we're talking about innovation today and breakthrough inventions, but we also found in our research that this rising short-termism is really strongly correlated, not only with institutional investor behavior, but things like whether or not there's a lot of activist investor behavior in the same sector, right, which can cause firms to engage in more short-term actions to shore up defenses against activist engagement. We also found that short-termism is correlated with more short-term executive compensation schemes, for example. So there's a lot of characteristics that we do find because we can estimate it at the firm level. And that was very important to us, that you know, just describing what's going on overall in a market doesn't provide a lot of information about both firm strategy as well as policy changes that might be important. Showing that this is happening consistently for firms over time has enormous implications, because we know that we can't just point the finger and say, well, actually, there are some firms that are just doing all the work in this area, or they're becoming private firms or things like that. We can actually say, no, this seems to be a very pervasive phenomenon across these firms. And there are other implications too, which is, given that the vast majority of individuals' pension plans, retirement funds are placed in the public capital markets, if those firms are not engaged in, you know, R&D that's going to promote next generation innovation, et cetera, and grow the market, one might question the ability of those funds to sort of grow, right? That's the access that, you know, retail investors have to, you know, their retirement prospects, essentially. And so there are many implications that go beyond the firms and the policies, but it was very important for us to get at it at the firm level.
And how did you think about this public-private issue? Can you talk about that a little bit more? Because I think you have some private company data as well.
We do. So we have the private company data primarily around innovation, right? So what we don't have is the same level of financials, and we certainly can't estimate that same short-termism measure for private firms. But what we did do is look at breakthrough inventions over time for public and private. So one of our hypotheses or one question that one might raise is, well, maybe what's happening is there's just a shift in who's conducting this innovation that's focused on breakthrough inventions or next generation technologies, and that maybe it's happening in the private capital markets. And so we wanted to know, well, are we seeing that shift, right? Like through looking at the same measures of breakthrough inventions. And we find the same patterns there in among private firms over time too. So we're not seeing this big shift from one to the other. And we also know from, say, research on hedge funds and private equity that their holding periods of firms are relatively short, you know, maybe 1 to 2 years on average, which is really or far too short for the kind of long-term time horizon a firm would need to take in order to engage in these long-term investments and breakthrough inventions. Which is not to say firms shouldn't also make short-term bets. They absolutely need to. It's the whole portfolio. But the issue is that we're neglecting potentially these longer-term bets, which not only are important for the firms and their competitiveness, but the economy as a whole.
Well, that was exactly what I was going to ask next. If we think about, so there's rising short-termism at the firm level. Those firms are less responsible for breakthrough innovations. The investors are important. You see the impact of the activists, and it's not just shifting from public to private. Where is that innovation going? Is it going to another country? Or maybe that's impossible to say based on the data, or is it just not happening? Because I think that is sometimes part of the crux of the implication side, which is this just, you know, jello and it's just moving around, or, you know, are people just not inventing things that would actually be really useful for society to have?
That's an excellent question and one that's difficult to answer definitively. There are, as you know, I'm sure, many floating hypotheses out there. Gee, maybe innovation is just getting harder. We've discovered all the easy things now and it's just getting harder. I'm not sure that's accurate. What we see is sort of very much this changing nature of R&D, as I alluded to already in the public and private capital markets. If you also look among startups and the kinds of inventions that, say, venture capitalists are funding, it's becoming a narrower and narrower sector, right? So they're much less focused on things like materials science, innovation, et cetera, than they used to be. So, you know, if, say, Dow or DuPont was still engaged in material science development of new chemicals, you know, at a very basic science level, would we see breakthrough inventions? Well, there's no guarantee, right? Innovation is a very idiosyncratic kind of activity. But I think what it's fair to say is that if you're only focused on the development side of R&D, which is taking existing compounds, for example, and just finding new uses for them or tailoring them to the needs of a specific client, all of which are important, then we know, though, that you're not going to generate breakthrough inventions. In terms of country dynamics, it's difficult to say there, too. This, while it's not in this research that I presented in Edinburgh, I have, and my co-author has done this for 25 capital markets around the world, the short-termism measure. And we find similar patterns in many countries in terms of rising short-termism. So these pressures are not unique to the United States and the firms that are listed here. This seems to be happening elsewhere. So my conjecture based on this evidence and the data that we have and the research that we've done is that probably we're just not engaged in that kind of innovation, and it's just happening less often and to a cost of human health and well-being, right? That's ultimately the purpose of innovation and the economy.
Right. I mean, that is the sort of, you know, back to Adam Smith, the ultimate mindset, which is innovation is helpful because we develop things that are useful for our societies, and then that generates the next. This is part of what we have to figure out how to turn around and reverse. But your data is very compelling in that this is not just, you know, looking at the past with rose-colored glasses or complaining about the accountability of markets, or so those are the issues that we often hear when people say, oh, short-termism isn't really a problem, but it clearly is a problem, particularly for innovation.
Absolutely. And I think we do know some things about turning it around, right? So we know that more patient capital is very important, right? And this doesn't mean lack of accountability by firms, which is sometimes how it's interpreted. So there are ways and mechanisms for communicating around projects that have what we would call high information asymmetry between the firm and the market. You know, the market doesn't fully understand all the R&D that's going on within the firm. So we know that we do need patient capital. We also know that executive compensation schemes are really important. You get what you pay for. If you're tying them to short-term stock prices, that's what you're going to get in abundance. So tying them to the kinds of things that we care more about and being a little bit thoughtful, this is already happening in sort of the ESG space. It's just starting where executive compensation is starting to be tied to important measures for a firm, say, around climate or diversity, equity, inclusion metrics, hiring metrics, things like that. So it is possible to do this around other things. We have to decide the things we care about. And I think what we're learning is short-term financial performance is not necessarily the panacea that we had hoped it would be in terms of, quote, market efficiency and raising all boats.
Right. I think if short-term performance is an indicator of long-term performance, then it works well. I think the challenge we have is that short-term performance is not always an indicator of long-term performance. And particularly if you're measuring it on different metrics, then it feels like it should be a milestone. People sometimes say, well, the long-term is a series of short-terms, but it's not really, because, you know, you take twists and turns and deviations, particularly when it comes to innovation. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. We know that it depends very much on the length of the investment cycle for the firm and the sector that it's in. So we know that, you know, for firms that are in industries where the investment cycle is a certain length of time, like, you know, let's just take the auto industry, for example. There's a certain number of years that is the length of the investment cycle for, say, a new vehicle, right? And it might even be longer for certain new technologies like the electrification of vehicles, which is what we're seeing now, and some of these kind of passive driving systems, et cetera. So there's even longer term cycles around that. So if your time horizon is not matched to that, but it's shorter than that, then you're not going to make that investment in, say, the next automobile or, say, the electrification of vehicles. Now, if instead your time horizon is relatively short, or the investment cycle is relatively short, having a shorter term time horizon doesn't matter so much for that firm in that sector. But the problem, as we've already talked about, is that this is pervasive. It's happening across firms, across industry sectors, including those that do have these long investment cycle windows.
So was there anything that really surprised you about the results of the study, of this most recent study, or was it mostly building on the, you know, the work that you had done in the past and therefore sort of validating of that?
So what was most surprising to me was how strong and pervasive the results were. We had this hypothesis that short-term oriented firms were less likely to be engaging in breakthrough innovation. What we didn't expect is that most firms are becoming more short-term oriented over time, and that this means that most firms are not engaged in breakthrough innovation, right? Or breakthrough inventions, and that is really declining. So it was really, and the techniques that we use to estimate these relationships are something called these epistemic maps, which allows us to estimate hundreds and thousands of regressions looking for the basic result or the relationship of interest, controlling for a whole variety of different things, different control variables, different lag structures, different constructions of variables. And what this means is that our results are not sensitive to these choices that researchers make all the time in terms of measure this, not that, construct it this way, not that way, the particular measure. But our results are entirely robust to all of those decisions across thousands of different regressions. I think that was the surprise to me, because almost always in research, you find that results are ultimately sensitive to choices that the researcher makes. And that's fine. It just means that we have to qualify our results and say, well, it, under these conditions, this relationship holds. What we found is that across the board and anything we could throw at it, that rising short-termism means lower breakthrough inventions, period.
Yeah, that is a very compelling sort of bottom line, which is robust results that rising short-termism is real and is leading to lower breakthrough innovation. So that should be a clarion call to really work on this challenge and this issue. So how did you choose to research this topic in, how did you get started on being curious about this topic and this, particularly this sort of the intersection, if you will, between business and the investing side of it? Because not many people have looked at both of those sides coming together in the academic community.
You mean when you say business and the investing side, you're talking about like investors in
the investors' impact on the behavior of the companies themselves. Yeah.
Right. Right. So two-part answer. What got me interested in thinking about short-termism and examining that in the first place was I do a lot of work around environmental sustainability, DEI initiatives in the firm, and making the business case for those things, right? So this is not philanthropy. This is good business practices. And I am one of many academics who have shown some of the positive effects on the bottom line for firms, right? Yet what I often observed is firms not undertaking those actions. And so I became very curious, well, why not? Because we're showing that these things can really improve performance for firms under certain conditions, and other times it's more universal. And one of the reasons as to why firms weren't engaged in these behaviors was, I can't think about that. I have to think about the earnings this quarter, right? Or this half year, or in a relatively short time frame. That wasn't the only reason, but that was one of the reasons. And I thought, huh, that's very interesting. I wonder how pervasive that phenomenon is, and became very interested in examining that. And as the research with my co-authors progressed around short-termism, what we found was, gee, this is a huge phenomenon. And these investments in, say, developing a more sustainable, resilient supply chain, investing in workplace practices and development that are better for the long-term retention and productivity of its labor force and well-being of its labor force. In addition to those being, you know, more long-term investments in the sense that you see the returns over the medium to long-term, maybe not in 3 months or 6 months, but in a year or 3 years, et cetera, is that, well, gee, if they're not investing in those things, maybe they're not investing in R&D either on this longer term time scale. And we saw lots of anecdotes in the press about this, about how firms were changing the nature of their R&D. And so that's what became interested in. Now, of course, looking at short-termism and the fact that it's rising, the question was, well, why is that happening, right? Is this something within firms? Is it trading? What is it? And there are a lot of reasons. It's not a simple explanation that's reducible to one point. But one consistent parameter that has always come up is, what's the pressure on the firm to return short-term earnings? And that comes from pressures around stock prices, which comes from executive compensation, but also the things that affect that stock price, which is investor behavior. And so to the extent that investors are shorting a stock or turning it over rapidly or engaging in more quant-based strategies like momentum trading and things like that, that are less tied to fundamentals and more tied to these movements and volatility and stock prices, the more we see this short-termism rising over time. And so that's, again, not the only factor, but it's a big one. And might be the most significant one. So it came from our investigations of why is short-term increasing over time. And that's what led us to look at the behavior of investors along with the behavior of business hand in glove. And so you cannot look at a firm's strategy and make recommendations without understanding the incentives of its investors.
And I think this is one of the key distinctions between markets today and, you know, back to Adam Smith and this prize in Adam Smith's day, it was really the sole proprietor, you know, the butcher, et cetera, where the owner of the business is the operator of the business. And there is no distinction between those. But of course, that's not the way most businesses run, or at least large businesses run today. And so understanding that connection is really important and takes us, you know, beyond where at least much of the sort of classical economics as well as legal mindset, I think, historically has been. So it's an important distinction that sometimes people get lost. They think about owning a business like owning a sole business or owning their house or something like that. But of course, that's not the way investors work. They have very diversified portfolios that are traded constantly and so on. Yeah,
absolutely. And their incentives are different, right? So in the era of the sole proprietor, the proprietor was embedded in the community with which it transacted. All the employees were neighbors, right? So that leads to a very different incentive structure than today. So, you know, and even if you go back 30, 40 years, you know, larger companies were also much more embedded in their communities. We didn't have the same degree of separation of ownership and control as we do now. And so that's brought up a number of issues. And what's interesting is that we always point to kind of the efficiency of markets and how that raises all boats. And then there's some truth to that, right? So we're not throwing that out. But I think what we've neglected to pay attention to is how very different our businesses and markets are from the time, like you said, of Adam Smith or even 40 years ago. And so that maybe our assumptions about true efficiency of markets and what that's getting us or what that means is changing over time. And this brings us a little bit into thinking about Adam Smith, right? So we point to Adam Smith as, you know, the invisible hand of the market, and everybody should be acting in their own best interest. And that leads to, you know, greater efficiency and benefits for all. And that interpretation is fine if it's also taken in conjunction with his earlier work, which is the theory of moral sentiments. And that is that there is a moral fiber or fabric that's underlying the community and these decision makers who are taking their own self-interest into heart. So that there's empathy or sympathy for others. So when you are making your decisions,
yes, you are acting in your own self-interest, but with awareness of those in the communities around you. And it's not this sort of atomistic, completely self-interested, isolated from your community and the rest of the world making decisions, which it kind of has become now.
Well, I think you can see why the judges decided to give this prize to you, Richelle. And I can't speak for Adam Smith, but I'm willing to bet that if he were alive today and walked into Panmure House again and saw you there presenting this work and discussing, he'd have a million questions for you. And it would be like the days of the Scottish Enlightenment when he gathered people in that house to discuss a lot of different areas. So, congratulations again on winning this prize, and congratulations and just thank you for this work. I think that your work has really pushed the academic thinking on short-termism, the impact on innovation, the role of the investor so much farther than it had before. There are, as you said, there are a lot of anecdotal thoughts about this, and a lot of people have felt these things, but that's very different than being able to do really robust academic work on it. So congratulations again on the prize, and thank you so much for explaining it to us.
Oh, it's been a delight and pleasure. Thank you so much for your kind words and this opportunity to talk about this work and providing a forum for this exchange. So thank you.
That concludes another episode of Going Long with FCLT Global. We hope you enjoyed our conversation today and encourage you to continue exploring our resources and research at www.fcltglobal.org. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share with others who may find value in Going Long with FCLT Global.